So here we go with Luke chapter 19. He entered Jericho and was passing through it. A man there was named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was short in stature. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much." Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." As they were listening to this, he went on to tell a parable, because he was near Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So he said, "A nobleman went to a distant country to get royal power for himself and then return. He summoned 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 pounds and said to them, 'Do business with these until I come back.' But the citizens of his country hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, 'We do not want this man to rule over us.' When he returned, having received royal power, he ordered these slaves to whom he had given the money to be summoned so that he might find out what they had gained by trading. The first came forward and said, 'Lord, your pound has made 10 more pounds.' He said to him, 'Well done, good slave, because you have been trustworthy in a very small thing, take charge of 10 cities.' Then the second came, saying, 'Lord, your pound has made 5 pounds.' He said to him, 'And you rule over 5 cities.' Then the other came, saying, 'Here, Lord, here is your pound. I wrapped it up in a piece of cloth, for I was afraid of you, because you are a harsh man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow.' He said to him, 'I will judge you by your own words, you wicked slave. You knew, did you, that I was a harsh man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow? Why then did you not put my money into the bank? Then when I returned, I could have collected it with interest.' He said to the bystanders, 'Take the pound from him and give it to the one who has 10 pounds. And they said to him, 'Lord, he has 10 pounds. I tell you, to all those who have, more will be given. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and slaughter them in my presence.' After he had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he had come near Bethphage at Bethany, at the place called the Mount of Olives, he sent two of the disciples, saying, 'Go into the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you will find tied there a colt that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it, just say this: The Lord needs it.' So those who were sent departed and found it as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They said, 'The Lord needs it.' Then they brought it to Jesus, and after throwing their cloaks on the colt, they set Jesus on it. As he rode along, people kept spreading their cloaks on the road. As he was now approaching the path down from the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the deeds of power that they had seen, saying, 'Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven.' Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, order your disciples to stop.' He answered, 'I tell you, if these were silent, the stones would shout out.' As he came near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, 'If you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. Indeed, the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up ramparts around you and surround you and hem you in on every side. They will crush you to the ground, you and your children within you, and they will not leave within you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation from God. Then he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling things there. And he said, it is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers. Every day he was teaching in the temple. The chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people kept looking for a way to kill him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were spellbound by what they heard. The word of the Lord. So, Jericho's basically the last place of any consequence you're going to pass in a pilgrimage route to Jerusalem. And we all know the ancient history of Jericho, and you know, when Joshua, the Israelites, entered the land and marched around the city seven times, and on the seventh time they blew the shofars and the walls came tumbling down, and it was their first conquest in reclaiming the promised land that God had promised them. And he's surrounded by crowds, as he very often is, and there's a guy named Zacchaeus there, and if we can thank Luke 19 for anything, it's for the wonderful children's song. There once was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. Do you remember this one? He climbed up to a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. And Jesus said, Zacchaeus, you come down, for I'm going to your house today. For I'm going to your house today. You never heard that one? You know it? Okay. Well, if you know it, you should sing along. And if you don't know it, by all means, we should have a...
Harsh Baptist upbringing or something.
That's where I learned it. I grew up Methodist, and I learned that in... we had something called the Bible Bowl when I was a kid. It was an interdenominational, ecumenical thing, which for that period of time in that part of the world was very strange indeed. And it basically did boys against girls, and you got points for memorizing things from the Bible. So if you could recite the Ten Commandments, you got 10 points. If you could recite the 12 disciples, you got 12 points. If you could recite all the books of the Bible in the order in which they come in the Bible, you get 66 points. And you do that for a year, and then at the end of the year, whoever had the most points got first dibs on this enormous Hot Fudge Sundae. And it was huge. It was the sparklers in it on fire and everything. And but, you know, once you sang the song and prayed the prayer, you know, the boys or the girls, whoever won it, would rush to get it, and the leaders would stop and say, no, the first must be last, and the last must be first. We cannot earn our way to grace. It was a wonderful experience as a small child. I was a Bible boy.
Made a great impression.
It did. And so, anyway, Zacchaeus is a chief tax collector. He's not just any tax collector. He is a chief tax collector. Which we're not sure what that means, but it may mean that he had other tax collectors under his supervision. So in addition to the cut that he would take from his own collections, if in fact he did man a booth, he would probably also get kickbacks from the people that he was responsible for. So this was a wealthy man, and one who would have been incredibly unpopular. Nobody likes a tax man. Nobody does. And especially when a lot of those taxes go towards supporting an occupying power like Rome, who is oppressing the people when they would much rather be free. So this man is, as the French would have said in World War II, a collaborateur. He's short, and he can't see over the crowd, but he's eager to get a glance at Jesus, so he climbs up to a sycamore tree, which are plentiful in that part of the world. And Jesus sees him up in the tree and says, come down, I'm staying at your house. I guess when you're Jesus, you can just invite yourself over whenever you please. He was happy to welcome him, Zacchaeus was, but then all who saw it were grumbling. I love that sort of contrast between the happiness and the grumbling. He's going to eat with this sinner. In the way they were probably thinking and feeling and saying it, sinner in the text should probably be capitalized S, sinner. He takes Jesus to his home, and he says, I'm going to give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I've defrauded anybody, I'm going to give back four times as much as I took from them. I love it. If I've defrauded anybody, every confession is partial, isn't it? every confession is partial. Now, this was particularly generous in terms of restitution, because if you go back and you look at Leviticus and Numbers, four times the amount that you stole or cheated somebody of, that was about the maximum penalty that could be incurred for involuntary restitution. So in other words, if you cheated somebody and they brought you before a judge, you didn't strike a plea bargain or anything, and you stuck to your guns, and at the end of the day the judge said, yeah, you cheated this guy $20, you owe him $80. You know, that was kind of like the maximum sentence you could give. Voluntary was usually 20% of whatever you'd taken from them. So here's Zacchaeus, and let's say he cheated somebody of $20. He's offering to give that person $80, when in fact, according to the law, all he has to do is give that person $4. So what has motivated him is not revealed. We can simply assume that he has heard, as so many have, of the miracles that Jesus has performed, of his wise teaching. He's gotten himself excited. There's a movement afoot, literally, as Jesus enters town, surrounded by these crowds, so thick that he can't see over them. And then Jesus in verse 9 says, today salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek out and save the lost. Now there are a couple of different ways that you could look at this, but one important one is that Zacchaeus' actions saved his own household. Now that would have just been natural, because the paterfamilias of a household, if that person did something, the entire family did it. So in early Christianity, it was not a matter of individual choice. If the father of the family decided to be baptized, everyone in the family, including the slaves, were going to be baptized as well. And for prominent women leaders in the post-resurrection movement, for them to have been baptized, they would have at least had to have obtained the permission of their husbands. Or at least that would have been the normal way going through that. Obviously, we're in a much less hierarchical society today, thank God. But what it does point to is the fact is that salvation is not just an individual reality. Salvation is a corporate reality. And we always have to be very mindful of that. We're all members of the body of Christ. And so we're in this together, not just for ourselves. And verse 10 in particular, I'm sorry, the last part of verse 9 where it says, because he too is a son of Abraham, it's unclear if this is an affirmation of the fact that despite all the nasty things that he had done, he too was still a child of Abraham. He was a member of the broader Judaic family. But it also could be a hint, especially knowing Luke the way we know Luke, it could be a hint that Zacchaeus was a Gentile. Because part of Luke's project is to broaden Jesus' mission beyond Judaism to Gentiles. Other Gospels, Mark in particular, places some emphasis on that. But remember, Luke then goes on to write the Acts of the Apostles, which predominantly consist of the missionary journeys of Paul. And the friction that was there between Paul and Peter and James and John about the conversion of Gentiles and what that represented. So you could interpret that either way. And then he repeats, as he's done before, you know, I didn't come here for the healthy, I came here for the sick. And by the way, all of you are sick. You're sick people. And he goes on to tell a parable because he's nearing Jerusalem and he can read the crowd. He senses the energy. They supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately because people are beginning to speak to him as a Messiah, and their vision of Messiah, taken from their interpretation of Old Testament text, especially prophets, was that it would be a King David figure who was going to go in and beat the Romans up and throw them out, and Israel would be free again to do whatever they pleased. So he tells this story about a nobleman who goes to a distant country to get royal power for himself. In other words, he's going to appeal to a king to become a governor of a province or something like that. And he summons 10 of his slaves. And there are similar stories in the other synoptics, but they deal with smaller numbers of slaves, much larger amounts of money. And in this case, he gives each of the 10 an equal amount, instead of the others where he gives them differing amounts. So he gives them 10 pounds, which is how we've chosen to translate the word mina into English. A mina was 30 denarii, which was about, 90. A mina was 90 denarii, which is about a day's labor. So this is 3 months' wages. It's a substantial amount. It's not like the talents that Jesus gave, which, if memory serves, was around 47 pounds of gold. But it's still a significant amount of money. And he said, do business with these until I come back. Very clear instructions, do business. The people, though, in this area really did not like this guy. And so they they sent a group of representatives after him to try to argue against the royal power, not to give this guy any more power than he already had. He gets back, he receives the royal approbation, and he brings the slaves around to see what happened. And the first one comes forward and says, look, I took the 10 pounds and I have generated 10 more pounds. So he's doubled it up. And he said, nice job. I'm putting you in charge of 10 cities. He could do that now. He couldn't do that before because he didn't have the royal approbation. But now he can put somebody in charge over a city or over 10 cities, over 5 cities, because the second guy comes and he's made 5 pounds what would that be, 90? 450 mina. He's made 450, 150, anyway, okay. Brain calculator not working, cell phone forgotten in the car. So this guy came up. He didn't do quite as well, but he had made a 50% increase. And the other 7 kind of get lost in the shuffle, and this guy comes up, and he's taken the money, he's wrapped it in a piece of cloth, and he says, I was afraid to do anything with this because, you know, if I lost it and came back and had less, God only knows what you would have done, because you're just a mean SOB and you cheat people all the time and you take things that aren't yours. And the man gets mad, and we don't know if this allegation made by this slave is true. It's easy just to make the assumption that it is, because this is a rich and powerful man with lots of assets and servants and enough political sway to be named governor over a region. He says, you knew who I was, or at least who you think I am, and despite that, you didn't take the safest possible alternative to at least yield some gain, which would have put it into an interest-bearing account, where there would have been at least a little bit more by the time I'd gotten back. And so he says, take that guy's pound away and give it to the guy who has 10 pounds. And the crowd says, but he's already got 10 pounds. And I'm reading it thinking, who cares about 10 pounds? He's got 10 cities. I mean, when you're in charge of a city, you know, it's like one of those, what was his name? James Brown songs. You know, it's your money maker. It's your money maker. If you're in charge of a city, it's a money maker for you. What is 10 pounds? It's nothing. And he says in 26, I tell you, to all who have, more will be given, but from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. And that's disturbing for us because grace is free. And it's given to any who choose to accept it. And this idea of a parable dealing with the coming of the kingdom of God, involving people earning promotions, earning stature and approval, is very, very upsetting. But the reality is that what was given to those slaves was never really theirs. It was given to them to do something with, do business with this. And faith is very much the same way. We're given faith. And we're meant to do something with it. And it's not a strict analogy. If you have faith and you practice your faith will grow. It will multiply. And as your faith multiplies, the horizon of what you're able to do to hasten the coming of the kingdom of God will grow. Even if you've been given responsibility over something that's very, very small. You know, if you're responsible in that, then your faith grows and more opportunities come your way to spread the good news, to serve God and His church, to witness to the love of Jesus. If you don't practice your faith, though, it's kind of like a fig tree that's withered. It decreases in value, and pretty soon you don't have any at all. Faith isn't something you can just sort of sit there in your heart, giving you a warm glow. A faith is meant to be worked with. It's meant to be a transactional reality. It's meant to make relationships. I mean, a commercial exchange fosters a relationship. We have people who service our HVAC systems, and we have a contract with them. And at any point, that relationship can be broken. But as long as they provide the service we need and we provide them the money for their service, that relationship will continue to grow. So this faith relationship, if nothing's done about it, it will not grow. And we won't be in a position where we can be responsible for helping others in their faith, because if you yourself have none, you're helpless to help others with their faith. That's what this is about. And of course, it gets worse in 26. The big man says, in 27, these enemies who didn't want me to be king, bring them over and kill them. And certainly, if anything, the reverse, because there were many people who did not want to acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah, many who never would. But Jesus' attitude would have never have been during his lifetime or after his resurrection that his enemy should be brought and slaughtered in his presence. Now, there will be judgment, and so maybe this is just a very graphic way of illustrating the judgment of those who oppose God's chosen Messiah. But it's a bit gritty. And they go on ahead and they get to Bethphage and Bethany, which is just a few miles to the east of Jerusalem. And this concludes this great journey to Jerusalem that began all the way back in chapter 9, verse 51, which I think we were probably studying in October or something like that. And he's at the Mount of Olives and he sends in two disciples to get a colt that's never been ridden. The detail never written is important, because you see lots of instances, not just in the Bible, but in ancient history, where if a conquering general is going to ride into a city in triumphal procession after having defeated an enemy, that general, instead of riding his own mount, would usually ride a new mount, which would usually be the gift of the emperor. It's like a brand new car. You know, you sit inside a brand new car, and it's a very different feeling when there's 24 miles on the odometer, and you tell yourself, well, nobody else has ever really driven this, instead of doing what I do, which is to go to CarMax, sit down to test drive the car, there's 64,000 miles on it, and saying, oh yeah, well, Hello, baby, boss number four in the seat. And this is repeated in other Gospels, and it's an intriguing thing because there's a bit of providence around this. You're going to go, you're going to find a colt never been ridden. How you know whether a colt's never been ridden or not, I'm not sure. Maybe it still has the MSRP sticker on the side. And then you're to go to the people and untie the colt without their permission, and only when they ask what you're doing, tell them in the vaguest of all possible terms, the Lord needs it. And there's been all kinds of speculation that there had been prearrangements that Luke didn't mention or was unaware of, that a colt had been made ready for Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. It doesn't make any difference. It's just that what the Lord needs will be provided. And you tuck that way in the back of your mind for later, when we get to situations that are going to be much more challenging than finding a suitable animal to ride into the city with. And unlike the other gospel stories where crowds are all gathered around, it's pretty clear here that it's just Jesus' disciples. And we know this because they're shouting out things. Quoting little snippets of scripture from Psalm 118 and Zechariah chapter 9. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven. And the Pharisees tell him, make your disciples stop. And so this is not just the 12, but it's probably a larger group of people. You know, any community that's focused around a common purpose, it's kind of like our solar system. You know, so I just finished my part of the parochial report and put it in Judy's box last night. And one of the categories is how many baptized members do you have? Okay. How many active members in good standing do you have? And there's a big difference. And so we have a lot of baptized members. We have several hundred baptized members. But in terms of active members in good standing, we have about 300. And that 300 is the core. Those are the people who do 99.5% of the work around this place, who give all of the money. And the other, 300-400 people are folks that we see here and there every once in a while. Most of them are people who grew up here. And when they grew up, they stopped going to church, or they started going to a church, and it was a church that didn't have the same practices that we do, where, you know, when somebody comes to this church, I say, what church is your membership in? Oh, such and so. Okay, we're going to send them a letter as a courtesy to let them know that you've found a church home now that you've moved to Louisville, and they'll feel good about that. Or if it's somebody who transfers in from another church here in town, we're going to send them a letter, and I know it's a little awkward, but it's going to help them think about what might have happened, that you've chosen to no longer worship with them. And on the rare occasion, it happens about once a year, that somebody at St. Luke's will transfer to a different church here in town, I call that person immediately if I get the letter from the other church and say, is everything all right? Did we do something? Just try to find out what caused this. Most churches, though, don't bother with that. They don't bother with that courtesy, which I think is very important pastorally. So we just have a lot of deadwood on the roster. We probably have 50 dead people on the roster that we don't know if they're alive or not anymore. Seriously. Because they were entering on the roster before I was born. And maybe they live two blocks away, and maybe they live in Alaska. We have no idea. And there's no way to purge a role in the Episcopal Church. So this is probably the 12, along with the women, along with maybe sort of a secondary tier of people. But Luke kind of downplays this triumphant entry because of the role that it plays in Jesus making his way to the cross is less pronounced in Luke than it is in others. Each gospel author has their own story to tell, their own way of portraying Jesus, and this is just one of the details Luke has slightly different. And he answers the Pharisees, well, if I told them to shut up, the stones would shout out. And again, I think that that broadens. I'm going to keep running my mouth while I get more coffee. I think that that broadens the reality of salvation. Because we've already seen multiple times in Luke, as we will in Acts, or actually as we did in Acts 3 years ago when we were studying Acts, that this small group are far from the only ones who will follow Jesus. And the entire creation is, Paul puts it so elegantly in chapter 8, the whole creation is groaning, awaiting the return of Jesus. And so the salvation of Jesus is not about a small handful of people. It's about the entire cosmos being transformed by the power that's released through his cross and his resurrection, and certainly in his anticipated coming again. Make sure I didn't miss anything there. He sees Jerusalem and offers a lament. His heart's just broken. He starts crying. And he said, if only you could see things for how they are. If you, even you, had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace. But they didn't. And Luke is writing, as you may recall, in the 80s. In 70 AD, Jerusalem was completely destroyed by the Roman 10th Legion after a four-year civil war. The temple itself was razed to the foundations. And there's actually a very practical prophecy here. If you had only recognized on this day the things that make for peace. And then he goes on in verses 43 and 44 to predict the awesome calamity that will befall Jerusalem. And if they did recognize him for who he was, the Jewish rebellion in 66 would have never happened. Think about that. Now, other things could have happened, because over time, Christians began to be persecuted, first sporadically and locally and individually, and then in a more systemic fashion that was ultimately endorsed by the empire. But these zealots, militating for the liberation of Israel through the use of armed force, what if all those people had become followers of Jesus? Almost certainly there would have been no rebellion in 66. Eventually, something probably would have happened, as it eventually did, but Jerusalem being destroyed as a consequence of it, probably not. So it is heartbreaking that they lost so much. In fact, they lost out twice. They eventually lost their sacred capital city. At the same time, they lost an opportunity to be followers of Jesus. And he walks into the temple and begins to drive people out. My house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it into a den of robbers. The temple was a complex facility. And National Geographic just did a great spread of the tunnels that are underneath the Temple Mount. My mom sent it to me, and I meant to bring my map up of the temple complex so you could see just how extensive and how complex it was. And in these sort of outer tiers, with the temple, of course, being at the center, that's where you got ready to do your sacrificing. And you could bring your own animal, but there were people there who had to determine whether it was clean enough to be sacrificed. It had to be pure, unblemished. And you can always find a blemish if you have the proper motivation. And so it was just safer and simpler to buy the animal you needed at the approved place from the approved people. You also would make not just a sacrifice of an animal or some grains, but you'd also make monetary contributions to the temple. But to do that, you couldn't use the currency in circulation because you're part of the Roman Empire. So what's your coins going to have on it? The head of the Roman emperor and his name, and that's idolatrous. You can't give that trash to God. So there's a place called Tyre to the northwest of Jerusalem on the coast, and Sidon, and there is a mint there that specialized in making shekels. And these were shekels that had no offensive imagery on it. And the shekels were produced not as a common currency, but purely as a temple currency. And so you would go in with your denarii, and you would trade it out for shekels. And since coinage was made from precious metals, mostly silver, you would weigh it out. Or there was an accepted exchange rate, 5 denarii for 3 shekels. This would have been an arena ripe for exploitation, and almost certainly was. We're all sinners, we're all human, we're all looking to make an extra buck, some more than others. But this was a system that Jesus saw as interfering, and it also was consuming space that could have been used for other purposes, like praying. But in Luke's gospel, unlike the others, where this action really puts Jesus squarely in the sights of the chief priests and the scribes and the other leaders of the people who, you know, are coming to the conclusion that he needs to die, it appears that it's his teaching in this instance that concerned them the most, because they couldn't find anything to do, for all the people were spellbound by what they heard. And so Luke sort of downplays the triumphal entry. It's a much simpler event. He downplays the cleansing of the temple as it's come to be known. It has to do with what he is teaching people, that exposes the abuses, the excesses, the omissions, and the ways in which the people are not being led in their faith in an optimal way, in addition to the fact that, oh yes, Jesus is the Messiah. He is Son of David and Son of God. And what follows basically is the Passion and Resurrection narratives of Luke when you get from 20 on, which is why I'm very much hoping between now and next Wednesday to get something together, perhaps a 5x7 card on chapter 16. The problem with 16 is it's befuddled so many scholars for so long that there are an inordinate number of ways you can interpret it at a variety of different levels. So anyway, that's all I've got about chapter 19 there. I can only imagine. Yeah.
Well, and you know, on that trip, wasn't there a sycamore tree there
in Jericho
that they were all talking about? This is the tree.
It's shiny. The Zacchaeus tree.
That had to have been a really big tree.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
It was enormous, but I mean, I thought,
really?
Really?
They are very long-lived trees.
True.
In ideal conditions, they can live to be a few thousand years old.
Well, that's what they claim, and they stood by it, and we said, really, like you said, and they said, absolutely not, this is it.
Zacchaeus tree.
Yeah.
Well, there's a tree in the Gethsemane. Wasn't in the Garden of Gethsemane that was supposed to be such
an olive tree?
There's an olive tree in there, yeah, in the garden.
But some of the olive trees have been grafted on roots, which makes them
redone over and over, which might be a possibility. But I think it's interesting that they mention the kind of tree it was. I mean, they just didn't say it was a tree.
Does the sycamore tree have any symbolism other than there's a lot of them over there?
Well, there's not a lot of them over there.
Oh, not, okay.
Well, I mean, this would be an environment where sycamore trees would flourish, and at one point, there probably would have been a lot of them, but as you see increase in population, you know, well, it's like Kentucky. You know, Kentucky used to be covered with this endless, pristine, primal forest of oaks and ash and maple, and, you know, there's a certain variety of trees you just don't see very much of anymore, even when you get out of the city. There's a little thing in my brain that's saying, you know, there is something about a sycamore tree that's of some symbolic significance. Since I can't remember it, I'm going to say that, like any good storyteller, the inclusion of irrelevant details is sometimes very important. He's painting a picture. And, you know, one of the things about sycamores is they have multiple trunks. Because we had two sycamore trees, my grandmother did. And we had to cut them down because they were unhealthy, and it was the most frustrating experience, because if you cut down six sycamore trees, you're basically cutting down five or six trees, because they have, from the ground, you know, we used to play inside them. I was so sad when we had to cut them down, because you could play inside them, and it was almost like being inside of a cage or something. And so I've always wondered, and I think this is just my imagination, not anything scholarly. He had a choice of which one to climb. And so he made a choice to see Jesus. He made a choice to climb a tree, which would have exposed him to ridicule, and certainly made his presence prominent in a crowd of people who did not like him at all. He had to choose which trunk to go up. And then and it was just a sequence of choices for him that were a process of redemption and release. You know, I mean, it's a scene where
it's something he definitely did not earn beforehand.
No, but Jesus obviously knew who he was.
Well, he's the heart knower. He knows us all.
Well, he knew that he was going to stay at his house, so he said, "Yeah." Mm-hmm. He knew who he was.
Yeah.
Maybe just by rumor.
Well, if I saw somebody, you know, perched up in the tree, you know, I would notice them, and you know, and if I noticed that they were of below average height, I might be able to put two and two together and say, "Oh, he's in the tree because he's too short to see over these crowds that are 8 or 10 people thick." What a determined person! Seeing me must be very important to him.
He's open.
And
he calls him by name.
And Jesus had that ability in Luke, where he could sense what others were thinking. Perhaps that was a supernatural facet of his sonship. Or maybe he was just an intuitive person. There are plenty of people who know what somebody's thinking, sometimes even before they themselves are thinking it. Stephanie's like that with me. But he was a chief tax collector. Jesus had been active in the area, and it's possible that the guy had a reputation. And you know, I'm sure that it's well within the bounds of reason to say that Zacchaeus would have been aware of a wealthy chief tax collector who was named Zacchaeus, and he was a short, midgety kind of guy who, you know, stole from everybody, and then he sees this short person who's going to be dressed in a regal way, and he's like, "Zacchaeus, yeah, I mean, it's your house tonight. Go turn on the Barbie." So,
I do think it's interesting about because he too is the son of Abraham.
Yeah.
You know, if he is indeed a son of Abraham, indeed a Jew, why would you even say that?
The next one in this says, "The Son of Man is going to search out and save what is lost." Well, this is the Son of Abraham, got himself lost. Okay, he was not acting like the son of Abraham. He was acting against his own people.
True.
And you could also say that Jesus was telling them, there's really nothing a person can do to exclude themselves from the covenant community. You can be unfaithful in the covenant with God. You have as an Israelite. And you can be unfaithful in ways that are deeply unjust to your fellow Israelites. But there's nothing that you can do that can boot you out of the covenant community. There's nothing anybody can do. You're in it. You're accountable for it. But you can't be tossed out of it. Kind of like the way we can't purge roles in the Episcopal Church. I cannot of my own volition randomly say, have no idea who this is. I've talked to 20 people. Nobody knows who this is. Strike them off the roll. And Judy, take one off the number of total baptized members on the parochial report. I can't do that. Because until they choose to no longer be part of this family of faith, they are.
I thought that was pretty interesting with regard to that, about the gentleman that was buried in here that was so very high in Brown Forman.
Yeah.
He'd never gone anyplace else.
Yeah, it happens all the time. And at the end of the year, I choose to put together a report for the vestry. Like, here are the people who transferred in, and here's how many there are. Here's who transferred out and where they went to. And we have weddings and baptisms, and we have burials. And so in 2019, we had 9 burials. And I think that it's unfortunate, because for the congregation, it lends the impression that we're a rapidly dying congregation. When in reality, only 3 of those 9 people were active members of the congregation. The other 6, I get a call from one of the children, or maybe the spouse, saying, oh, so-and-so grew up there and acolyted under Father Board, and he really would like to be, he talked about how he wanted to be buried out of St. Luke's. Well, and I'm in no position to refuse, nor would I want to be. It's an honor to offer people the last rites of the church. And they'll call up and say, he moved to Georgia and then Tennessee and then eventually back to Louisville, but, lived down in Shively or wherever and, linked up with this church, but never really got active there. And so for every funeral we do, there you go. For every funeral that we do, about 1 out of 3 is actually somebody who's an active member in good standing. So we're not a rapidly expiring congregation. We just happen to be, broadly defined, a large congregation of about 700 members, most of whom aren't affiliated anymore, but many of whom had such a powerful impact made in their lives by this place and its people that they prefer to have their funeral here in this place, in our way. And
I was here in the 70s with the 80s. My ex-husband, we moved all the time. He's from GE. And we moved from here because we got transferred out of town. And my kids were little when we lived here. And then because we taught Sunday school here, and I was on the altar field. We did a whole lot of things. And when I moved back to Canada, got divorced, and now I got to go back to St. Louis because I love that church. But that was in the 70s or the 80s that we were here. And I don't know if when we left, if we said we're leaving because we're being transferred or,
I think you did.
I think we did.
Because I remember signing your transfer request. And
you weren't here then.
Oh, well.
You weren't the minister here when we were here.
When you returned, though,
I
was.
When I returned.
So, yeah, when you started worshiping here, gosh, it's been almost 2 years, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I asked if you wanted to be a member, and you said, well, I was one.
Yeah.
And I told Dawn, I said, check the rolls for...
Yeah.
And she said, I don't have anything. And then I asked, where did you go to church last? And then we sent them a nice letter. So, transfer you back in. But yeah, something about St. Luke's, it has a hold on people in a way that no congregation I've served before ever has. And all of the congregations I've served have been old. In fact, this is the newbie. I found one church that I served was founded in 1734. The Cathedral of St. Philip was founded before the Civil War. I can't remember the year, but I know that it was founded before the Civil War, because when Sherman came into Atlanta, he used the cathedral, which at that point was downtown across from the State House, he used the cathedral as horse stables. And Good Shepherd in Lexington was founded in the late 19th century, just a few decades before St. Luke's. So, you know, those were all situations where the phenomenon we experience here at St. Luke's, you know, could have easily obtained, but didn't. And it just says something about this community laterally in time. I mean, we're so different from what we were 40, 50 years ago, but in a way we are who we are, and people love the place.
It's interesting about faith. I think we sometimes equate belief with faith.
Yep, great distinction.
And faith is a gift. Mm-hmm. You can't conjure that up.
Nope.
Our belief cannot even make it happen.
No.
And I do believe that. And your faith, even when you're having trouble believing, you still have your faith.
Mm-hmm. It's faith is a first order experience, and we use the words faith and belief interchangeably, and we really shouldn't, because belief is a second order reflective reality. Okay, so to believe in something, you have to have an experience of something. Like to believe that the sun rises from a direction called east. An experience would be having a compass that you rely on and waiting for the sun to rise and looking where it points north. And so now you have had this experience of the sun rising in the indicated place, and you believe it. But believing the sun rises in the east is nothing compared to witnessing a glorious sunrise and all of its beauty and promise. Faith is the same way. It's a gift. And we can think about our faith, and those thoughts are beliefs, but we can create our beliefs, whereas we can't create faith. Faith is a relationship, or maybe more precisely, faith is a grace that empowers us to have a reconciled relationship with God. That's, I guess, would be what I would define faith as. You know, faith isn't believing that Jesus was crucified. That's a belief. Faith is Jesus being crucified makes all the difference in the world for everyone, for all time. That's faith. Because the relationship teaches us that.
One of the things, too, that comes to mind about Patrick Israel is coming down, first of all, being at the Bethpage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're outside the little church that is there at Bethpage that has all kinds of references to that triumphal entry. But before we went in, we couldn't go down to Bethany because there was some unrest down there. It was just down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we could stand there and look down.
See it.
When I stood there and looked down, there was a donkey It was a big moment for me.
Wow, I bet.
Yeah.
There was a donkey down there. I took a picture of it, so I have a donkey down there. But the other thing is, when we were going down to the Garden of Gethsemane, there's a chapel there shaped in the shape of a tear, a teardrop. That's the commemoration of his weeping over Jerusalem. And inside, you're sitting here, you're looking at the altar, and above the altar, you see Jerusalem. But there's a kind of a railwork in front of the window in the shape of a cross. On the altar, you have a hen trying to gather her chicks. And the words of Jerusalem, I would gather you under my wings, but you would not let me. Then when I was doing that video, I was reading on, I was trying to find ways to narrate it, so I was reading. And this business here of the Lamentations saying, days will come when your enemies encircle you with a rampart, hemming in and press you hard from every side. Well, today, Jerusalem is hemming itself in with those walls that are trying to keep people out. And I think this passage is also a prophecy that will be their eventual downfall. Maybe not being conquered, but I just don't think this is what they're supposed to do.
Sometimes you can be your own worst enemy. And they're putting the walls up to prevent attacks, and particularly suicide bombers. And they've been very successful, actually. But if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, East Berlin-type walls delineate almost all of the territory that belongs to Israel and Palestine. The only areas where there are not walls, and these are serious walls, they're not, they're patrolled, but they're not armed. The only place where there aren't walls between the territory are areas where the government has plans to expand settlements onto Palestinian land as defined by the United Nations. And
that's Bethlehem, okay? That's the encroaching territory into Bethlehem.
Right.
And there are guards stationed there.
I mean, there are things that our enemies do to us, and then there are things that we allow our enemies to do to us.
And there are things we do to ourselves.
And maybe there was no other way to keep people from blowing up buses. But we do need to pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
We do need to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And we had an Israeli citizen who was also a Christian here as our guide, and he said something very profound. He said, if the news media and the politicians would leave us alone, we would find a way to live together because we did it before.
Well,
can I go back to 19 for a moment?
Please, yes. Chapter 19 or verse 19?
Chapter 19.
Okay, where are you?
Where you have in your notes, the palm branches or gestures of nationalistic undertones. Is that because the Romans did that kind of thing when they had a triumphal entry? They had palm branches?
Oh, when you had a triumphal entry for the Romans, it was quite a show. But palm branches were a symbol of liberation for the Jewish people in the 2nd century BC. In 167 BC, a rebellion was fomented by a family known as the Maccabees. Maccabees is Hebrew for hammer. And I think it was five brothers, or maybe a father and four sons. I can't recall that detail precisely, but it was against the Assyrians, particularly the Seleucid emperor Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He was a jerk. I mean, he thought he was God, hence the title Antiochus Epiphanes. He wanted to put a statue of himself, you know, in the temple in Jerusalem, and wanted to force them to eat pork and keep them from reading the Torah. I mean, he was destroying Torahs right and left, like Nazis burning books. This guy was just a terror. He was a psychopath. So they decided they had enough. And for 3 years, they actually, you know, of civil war, they actually managed to control a fair amount of territory, enough that they were able to mint their own coins and palm branches. Palm branches and pomegranates.
So that's why in verse 36, many spread their foes on the road.
That would have been another way of, you know, it's like the story of the
Montserrat and Queen Elizabeth.
Exactly. That, yes. Yeah. You throw your cloak over the muddy hole so that, you know, except in this case, it's not Queen Elizabeth, you know, keeping her shoes on muddy. You don't even want the donkey that Jesus is riding on to get its hooves muddy. They want to, in a way, it's making the way plain, like Isaiah says in the beautiful prophecy, which John repeats, that he's come to make this, the rough places straight and plain. And of course, oftentimes a person's garments were the most valuable thing they owned. Normally people didn't have a closet of garments. So whatever they throw down on the road, they're going to pick up again and wear it, or have to clean it, or whatever. And so that's definitely a sign of submission and an honor, and almost an expression of ecstatic joy that you would do something like that.
And welcoming.
I like that, the red carpet. And doesn't Jesus' donkey look beautiful tonight here at the Oscars? I love the sequins. Well, it's a little high cut for my taste, but well, so next week we will hopefully return to chapter 16, but we might enter into 20. I have a